The Citadel Cafe is proudly sponsored by TweakedAudio.com. For high-performance, noise-reducing earbuds, visit TweakedAudio.com and use our code TCC at checkout for free shipping and 30% off your entire order. That's TweakedAudio.com.
This is the Citadel Cafe.
This is the Citadel Cafe, episode number 112 for Wednesday, June 4th, 2014. My name is Joel Duggan, and the Citadel Cafe is where my friends and I gather together to talk about the geeky stuff that we are into. We cover everything from movies and television to books, apps, and websites. Joining me tonight is friend of the show, Ryan Murphy. Welcome, sir.
Hello.
Good to have you back.
Ah, you know what? I'm glad you brought me back for this episode of Game of Thrones, and also the equally disturbing iOS 8, and no, that's not true. I don't know, you remember when iOS 7 got released, everyone was like, oh my god, it's awful, and then right. Like Mac Yosemite Mountain Sam with two guns comes blazing out, and it's like, this is amazing. Yeah, I haven't heard as much flack about that as I have with iOS 7.
Well, it's less of a dramatic change, right? It's a little bit more iterative, and I feel like there's been some changes to the OS where, you know, they bring it out with the Apple products, and I feel like, well, I mean, the numbers show there are more people with iOS devices than there are with Macs. So, you know, so what they're doing now is what you're seeing, I find, over the last like 3 years, you're seeing new things and new styling happening with iOS, and then Mac OS is reactive as far as the design is concerned. The functionality and stuff, I mean, Mac, they have different features, although they're slowly becoming one giant Apple OS. Which was a prediction, actually, I saw. I can't remember the name of the journalist, but somebody had put out there, like, there will not be a Mac OS 11. Like, we're on, you know, Mac OS 10 Yosemite now, mm-hmm. or we will be in the fall. And the prediction was that there won't be an 11. It'll just, by the time they get through all these different, you know, iterations of 10, they will just eventually get to the point where it's just Apple OS. It'll be on your Mac, it'll be on your iPad, it'll be on your iPhone, and it'll all just jive.
Yeah, well, I mean, that brings to the point of that cool new feature they're calling continuity,
mm-hmm.
where, like, it's perfect for me, sucks for the guy who loves his Mac but hates his iPhone and has, like, a Google or an HTC or whatever. But for me, it's like, I know a lot of people joke around, but I love messages on the Mac because I can just respond to text messages on my computer and I don't have to, like, stop what I'm doing.
Yeah, beautiful.
So now I'll be able to do that for everybody, even if they don't own an iPhone. And I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, they're dropping the barriers. You know, like, there's other companies out there that, you know, raise the barriers where BBM is BBM only. Like, you have to have a BlackBerry to do it. And, I mean, obviously BlackBerry has gone the way of the dodo, but, like, the way that Apple handles that kind of stuff, I find, is not, they never do this out of the gate, which I find weird. They, like, they get criticized a lot for, like, they're not really innovating. They're just kind of catching up. But the way that they present it, it feels like they're innovating.
Well, it's also the fact that they make catching up look good, you know?
Well, like, there
I'm not worried about them being ahead of the pack. Mm. I just want a solid OS that's not janky. Yeah. I mean, some would say that Windows 8 was, or Windows Vista and Windows 8 were cutting edge, but only in certain segments. In the rest of the segment, it was a complete pile of trash. And then when they finally caught up to themselves, it was Windows 7 and supposedly probably going to be whatever they update Windows 8 with. Right. At least with Mac OS X, it's like, you're getting a new OS, you're getting features that, sure, your Android buddy had and gloated about for the longest time, but at least we're getting the Apple version. And I'm fine with that. I know a lot of people are probably listening and being like, ugh, Apple fanboy. Ah, well, whatever.
Well, you and I are both Mac users as well as iPad and iPhone users, are we not?
Yes. Yeah, I'm full-on iOS and Mac, except for my gaming PC.
Yeah.
And I use, that's where I do all my productivity. And I've even gotten to the point where like I use Windows 7 at work, and I'm less productive on Windows 7 than I am on my Mac, just because of the different tools that I have available to me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, when you do your website coding and stuff like that, because we've mentioned before when you've been on the show that you do web design. Do you do it on the Mac, or do you do it on the PC?
I have to use a Mac. I use a Mac at home, but for work I have to use a PC, just the type of corporate environment. But
right.
You know, the difference between like using Notepad and pasting it into like a code window on my Windows environment in comparison to like what I do on the Mac, it's essentially the same thing, but it's just the process is a lot more enjoyable. You know, Windows is clunky, but damn if it doesn't play good games. I guess that's
why. Well, yeah. I mean, I've had pretty good luck. I mean, the big game company that I was involved with for the last few years with my Mac was Blizzard, and they tend to do day-and-day releases of the same, you know, for Mac and PC. So for Warcraft, for Hearthstone, for Diablo, and anything else that I was playing, I could play it on my Mac. Now, my Mac is not meant for gaming. It's a good computer. It's a 2009 MacBook Pro. Mm-hmm. It was the first year the 13-inch was available in the aluminum unibody. So it's got some okay guts in it. I can still paint in Photoshop and do the high-end graphic work that I need. That's the only thing I can do when I'm doing that, though. Like, if I'm working on a big document that's, like, you know, print quality, 300 dpi or something like that, then that I can't really have a lot going on. I have Twitter open and stuff like that, but I can't really get into, like, you know, rendering a video at the same time in the background or anything crazy like that. And the render times on videos, if I'm making, like, a time-lapse for YouTube or something like that, they're, you know, somewhere around an hour to an hour and a half, depending on the length of the video, like, you know, 10, 15 minutes. So it's not a beast of a machine. It's also quite old now. Like, it's starting to feel a little bit long in the tooth. Some of the functionality of Mavericks I don't have access to, like AirPlay mirroring to an Apple TV, that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, so I can't quite do all that kind of thing. Because it'd be great to, like, when you get to the full screen surfing on Safari, to throw it up on the Apple TV and kick back on the couch and just kind of like browse DeviantArt that way, as opposed to, you know, doing it on the iPad or whatever. Because, I mean, sometimes when I'm looking at pictures, I like them larger rather than, you know, just in my lap. But what were the key features that you took away from the Apple announcement on Monday?
When it came to Yosemite, it's definitely the continuity that we talked about, and just the overall look and feel.
Right.
I like the design of iOS 7 and iOS 8, so I'm glad they're bringing it to the Mac, and now it's all going to look the same.
Mm-hmm.
The first 6 months will have some growing pain as your favorite apps like take their time to update. But
yes, yeah, there's always that. Not to mention that they usually have the option to turn a lot of this kind of stuff off if you don't like it. Or if, like me, your computer can't handle it. Because something that I've noticed with my iPhone 4, as pretty as iOS 7 is, it's a little bit slow on the 4, depending on what I'm doing. And that's something I feel would probably happen with, you know, Mavericks and, well, not Mavericks, but Yosemite, sorry, for my MacBook Pro. Some of this translucent Windows and showing your desktop and stuff through the Windows, as cool as that is, if it bogs down my system, I'm not going to care. Like I'll turn it off as opposed to have it look pretty, for me. Cause I mean, performance for me is a higher benchmark. I liked the dark view that they offered on Yosemite, where you can turn the light gray, you know, dock and menu bar to a transparent kind of darker, almost like a charcoal color. For me, when I'm working on the Cintiq, it's important to try to have kind of a balance of your windows and have the thing that you're working on be the brightest thing. So having the tools and the menu items and stuff kind of fade into the background until you need them. Cause it's hard on the eyes. I mean, like it's funny, you know, all those stories that you hear when you're younger about like, don't sit too close to the TV sort of stuff. I have it, like my Cintiq is 24 inches and I literally sit 18 inches from it, mm-hmm. you know? So, I mean, it is, it, I'm really close to the screen. And if they, I mean, I've got the brightness turned all the way down because if something is white, or a bright white window, you know, full of text or something like that, then it just, it can be really quite, quite jarring. So to have an opportunity to turn, you know, some of the other window features down would be welcome for me. For, I don't know about the best. I mean, I like the continuity thing. I mean, for people that, that haven't seen the demonstration, the continuity is just basically your devices will know when they're near one another so that, you know, if you get a phone call on your phone, you can answer on your Mac. If you are working on a spreadsheet on your Mac and you want to pop it open on your iPad will know that that's open and you can just kind of like flick up and open up that particular, you know, app on the iPad and continue mm-hmm. working that way. I can see that being really convenient in a creative work environment when, like, you know, you're working on a presentation or some sort of report and you need to walk into the next room and meet with two of your other, you know, coworkers about it. You don't have to like email yourself the file, email them the file, like between, you know, a cloud drive and, you know, this continuity thing, like you pop it onto your iPad. When you get there, you share it with the people that you're meeting with, and then, you know, it's kind of everybody talks about it, and then you take the thing back and it all updates automatically and keeps everything in sync. Like it looks like it's gonna be a really neat way to, I guess, work in a collaborative environment.
Yeah, I mean, the other cool thing that I just realized as I'm like sort of browsing through their website, I mean, one of my favorite things to do after an Apple keynote is not even sometimes watch the Apple keynote, but just go to their website afterwards, because they're always really good at summing up exactly what they've announced with their web design and mm-hmm. all the content. Mm-hmm. And another thing that I've noticed here is like the updates to Notification Center on both iOS 8 and Yosemite with widget support.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that I'm going to be able to have custom widgets on both my iPhone, iPad, and Mac is awesome, because now I can have, you know, little apps that wouldn't necessarily have access to the Today view. You know, I can remove stocks and actually put something useful in there, like a Twitter widget or something.
Yeah, exactly. Now, do you use multiple desktops on your Mac when you're working?
Yeah, I do. I have my Mac connected to my big monitor, and then lately, actually, because I find it's a lot easier when I'm working on different projects to kind of separate them by desktop.
Mm-hmm.
And my computer is a little more. It's only about a year, 2 years old, so it's a little more capable. I got to the point with my MacBook. I bought one in 2006 and I had it for 5 years and it was slogging. And I was at the point where it was like, if I don't upgrade this, I'm not going to be able to do work. So, it was due up for an upgrade, but, I usually have multiple desktops open and I usually separate my desktops by what I'm working on, but, it's just these little refinements that they're going with, and I'm actually surprised that they're doing all these new features alongside reskinning the OS. It's really cool.
Yeah, yeah, no, I agree. I send my mom, you know, to the Apple website because they're, like you said, so clear about explaining everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm trying to think about something else that, like, specifically like an iPad or an iPhone feature. I thought the voice messaging thing was neat. I don't know if I'm going to use it. Like, I'm not really sure. Mm-hmm. I thought it was really cool that you could just raise it to your ear and like speak into it like a walkie talkie, and then it sends it as a reply. I thought that was very cool. I'm not sure whether that would be less distracting as a driver or not. Like, I'm assuming you can do the same situation hands-free where you just like vocalize a reply and that gets sent as an audio message as opposed to having Siri translate and type a text message. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether it would be more distracting to have someone like on a live conversation with you via a phone call or whether a audio text message is something that is less distracting, you know, in a multitasking environment like a drive.
I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I usually have the golden rule with my phone that, like, if I'm driving, it's in my pocket. I don't do the whole hands-free thing, but anything that kind of allows you to do voice over text, I'm sure is handy. I don't know if people, like, usually when I'm texting, it's because I don't want to talk. It's like, oh, this is something that can be solved with text. We don't need to send like Roger, Roger, you know, to each other. But it is nice that they're sort of expanding on the type of messages you can send to each other, which I'm sure is, you know, something you could have easily done with the many messaging apps on the phone, on the App Store. But, you know, I've always been a fan of like built-in apps. If the built-in app is going to do it for me, I'm going to use the built-in app. I'm not going to have to, like, use hacky notification systems to be able to get into an app when I, like, for example, Sparrow on iOS. I was using that for the longest time. And because it didn't have push mail, I would leave push notifications on for the built-in mail. Mm-hmm. And then whenever a notification came in, rather than clicking on it, I would open my phone and go to Sparrow and load the mail. Which, yeah. To be able to use a better mail app, you certainly had to jump through a couple hoops. And Apple still hasn't got to the point where they're saying you can have default browsers. Like, I'll use Chrome on iOS before Safari any day.
Really?
I really enjoy being in that environment where I can look at my tabs and have my bookmarks synced that are on my Mac, that are on my iPhone, that are on my iPad. I know you can do that in Safari, but I really dig the Google environment for Chrome, but I know probably on the older phones it probably doesn't run as great because Google's usually a hog when they develop browsers for some reason.
Yeah, I feel like for me, it's just that I might be just used to Safari. I don't like Chrome on the desktop, and I think it's just easier for me to just kind of stay in the Safari universe.
Mm-hmm.
I do know, and I cannot wait for an update to Mail, because Mac Mail and Gmail lately are not talking well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I get my messages on my Mac now. I fixed whatever that problem was, but they don't sync up with my phone and my iPad as being read. At least not right away. Like, I have to open up the Mail app on the iPad and refresh the drop down, and then it'll say, oh yes, okay, the 13 messages you thought you had, no, you've already read 10 of them, you only have 3 new. Because you never have that you know, kind of panic where you're doing a project for a client, you've had a couple of emails back and forth and everything seems to be fine. You go and you check your Mac and your Mac says you've got 3 new messages, but you know that's like, you know, from your mother and, you know, some other people. And then you go to look at your iPad and your iPad says you have 13 new messages, you know, after lunch. And like, oh God, like what's happened with the file I just sent? Like, what deadline isn't being made? All this kind of thing. Like, so it's really annoying, and I'm waiting for them to fix it. I'm also having an issue where I used to be able to have, set up a certain number of smart mailboxes in Mail for certain flags. So you can assign different color flags. I've got them assigned to different hotkeys, which is something you can do with the OS. So, you know, like if something needs a reply, it's now an orange flag. If it's a task, it's a yellow flag. If it's just a read it later, like, you know, one of our, a mutual article, you know, you and I read about, like web design, I'll flag that with a blue flag. So it's not really priority. It's just like, if you have time to read it later, read it later. If not, no big deal. And then I've got some other things for reference, like, you know, like login codes for games or password changes and stuff like that, that I flag them with a green flag for about a month, just because I'm probably going to need to reference that in the next, you know, 4 weeks.
Right.
Unfortunately, the way that, in the last update, they changed the way that the smart mailbox works. And the default flag that I used to be able to put on there was a red one, and that was a needs reply today. And you can only assign one flag on iOS. So it made sense to, no matter what the thing was on iOS, if it was something I needed to look at later, I would flag it, mark it as red. When I got back to my desktop, I would have, you know, a list of 10, you know, emails in my needs reply box. I could quickly go through and say, okay, well, this isn't, you know, this deserves a blue flag and this deserves a green flag, and get myself down to like, you know, 2 or 3 emails that need to reply to, and then reply to them and I'm done. But now, the default red flag, you can't separate it out. So the only way to have a default red flag in the OS version of Mail, it now captures all the flags. So this folder is useless because it doesn't categorize everything. It's just like, this is just all the messages that are flagged, which I can tell you are, you know, in the, not in 100, but it's like, it's a better part of 50 messages in the course of a week. And you know, it's a lot to kind of slog through when you want to find something quickly, or if you want to process things that you've been, you know, doing while you've been out and about, you know, on your mobile device. So I'm kind of making it work right now, but it's taken what was a very efficient mail, technique to reducing it to something a little bit more annoying. So I'm trying to find a better solution, and I'm hoping with they didn't mention it, and I haven't looked it up, but hopefully with iOS 8, I will be able to assign colored flags.
Mm-hmm.
That would be handy.
It looks like with the iOS version of Mail on iOS 8, it's going to be pretty simple in terms of flagging one color. But I don't know. It's interesting. I mean, they added tags in Finder, so I would be surprised if they reduced the complexity of Mail to down to one color flag. But well, I don't know.
It's not the one color. It's just that for whatever reason, the default red flag in Mail, you can't separate it out. Like, you can't. It only ever gets called all flagged. Like, it doesn't. Everything else has got an orange flag or a yellow flag or a green flag, and you can totally pull those out and look at a folder with just the three orange flags in it. But you can't do that with the red ones anymore. And the red ones are the only ones that you can assign on iOS. So anyway, kind of a pain in the butt. But I guess we kind of got on about iOS for a little while here.
Mail talk.
Yeah. What have you been watching, man? Anything interesting?
Ashley and I finished Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. season one.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
I've heard mixed reviews, so would you recommend it as something Joss and I should check out?
If you're into the Marvel Universe, you have to watch it.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, the first half, even like the episode that has to deal with like the Thor movie that came out in November, is like a tie-in. It's stupid. It feels like they're trying to sell like Burger King cups. So the first half of the season is pretty monster of the week, pretty like cleanup crew, you know, what you'd expect from what the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. actually does. Mm-hmm. You know, they're a cleanup crew for these, you know, heroes that go around saving the universe by stomping New York into a pile of dust. But then the second half starts to get less, you know, starts to pick up, starts to deal with like season type stories rather than monsters of the week. Deals with the major twist in Captain America Winter Soldier, which I have not seen yet. So I had already spoiled the movie for myself by like internet memes. Oh. And then when I watch the show, it full on spoils that twist.
Right.
But what they do with that twist, it's less like what they did with Thor the Dark World in the sense that it was just like a marketing tie-in. They, well, obviously, as you know, seeing Winter Soldier, they had to take that moment and run with it.
Mm.
And I felt like if I, again, I was watching it sort of a month after it came out. So again, it's so easy for me to spoil things for myself. And I spoiled that moment. And the moment in the show that is, again, like I would even put it along the lines of maybe close to a Walking Dead or even maybe close to a Game of Thrones type twist. And
wow.
I haven't quite, I might be talking it up a bit, but it's something you wouldn't expect from like an ABC show that, you know, a 42 minute drama about, you know, these agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And I was impressed with what they did, and I think that by the end of it, I was like, okay, I'm excited for season two. I want to see where this goes, and I'm actually looking forward to how it'll tie in to the Marvel Universe going forward, because as we know, we only have, between the return of the show, we only have Guardians of the Galaxy, and I think Guardians of the Galaxy is going to be fairly on its own. Except for maybe like the post-credit stinger, which will probably be
right.
Like Avengers 2.
Yeah.
You know, which will probably deal with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. But I feel like going forward, I'm excited to see what they do with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. because I think that show is basically going to be a really good advertisement for Avengers 2.
Mm.
You know,
I heard people that knew that Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. was tying into Winter Soldier and watched everything in the right order.
Mm-hmm.
And it blew them away. Like, it was such a cool thing to be able to go see Winter Soldier, die for more, and then tune in next week on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. to continue the story. And I mean, leave it to, you know, Disney that, you know, owns Marvel and owns ABC to be one of the first, if not the first, company to put out a franchise that is, you know, tied in with a movie release and a television release at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, it's super ambitious, and of course the show has some growing pains. Like with the entire first half of the season, you'll watch it and you'll be like, man, this is just like cookie cutter, you know, ABC 42 minute drama about a team that solves, you know, it's like X-Files for the Marvel Universe or some sort of cop show. But then it totally, you know, just takes the football that agents or that Winter Soldier spiked and runs with it. And the last five or six episodes totally make up for, and the first half of the season obviously is building these characters and building up the relationships. And yeah, some of them are a bit cheesy and you're like, ugh, really? Okay. Girl A sleeps with girl B. That'd be a completely different twist, but
different network too.
Yeah, probably wouldn't be ABC, the Disney Channel. Try to keep it family. Not that wouldn't be family. You know what I mean.
I do.
But it's good, and I highly recommend it. And I'm looking forward to what they do with season two, especially with the announcement that they're going to be doing. They're taking it even a step further by filling in the winter break with a Agent Carter miniseries.
Nice.
So it's like Disney is just going to have nonstop advertising for their Marvel films, you know. And I think it was on Comic Dorks they were talking about it, how no way ABC is going to cancel Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. It's essentially an hour of primetime television to pimp their Marvel movies.
Yeah, it's cheaper to make the show than it would be to buy advertising on another show.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Especially when you can buy advertising to advertise the show that's advertising the movies, which I'm sure it's a lot cheaper to advertise Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. than it is to advertise Avengers. I mean, oh, I'm sure there's like, you know, some money exchange there. But no, it's great. And I mean, it's got to make you excited to see what they're doing with Marvel and then immediately look at what they're starting to do with Star Wars and think they're going to do the exact same thing and it's going to be great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Except Star Wars has always been attached to Fox. They took it away from Fox, right? It's with Disney wholly, so, right?
Star Wars was always Lucasfilm.
Oh, well, no, wasn't it like 20th Century Fox?
You're thinking about X-Men.
I'm thinking about like, you know, I'm probably wrong. I don't know enough about Star Wars, but I would think if Disney was to buy Star Wars, they would, you know, rip it all away from whoever had it beforehand.
Oh, they bought Lucasfilm wholesale. Like that's, yeah, they own everything now, yeah.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So, I mean, what they do with Marvel, they're going to do with Star Wars. And, I mean, they just, you know, the guy who directed Godzilla is directing a standalone Star Wars film for the year after Episode 7. And then they just announced today another director, the guy who's doing Fantastic Four, is going to be directing a standalone film.
Oh, cool.
So there's lots of news coming out, and they've always talked about doing a TV show, and I'm sure if Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is proving to be a worthwhile investment, we're going to see that Star Wars film or TV show in the next couple of years.
Yeah, and we're getting to the point, too, where CG effects in television shows, while not cheap, are at least good enough that they stand up to the movies. You know, like, it's something that can be done and can be done very well, and if you've got the money of Disney, Marvel, you know, and Star Wars, you know, behind you, then, you know, you can easily do a really powerful TV show. I mean, not that I think the special effects are everything, you know, obviously story is key, but when you're dealing with Star Wars, you're really going to pull the fan base out of it if you've got a great story but crappy special effects. Like, sci-fi really kind of needs a balance.
Yeah, you know, they're getting there. Yeah. I mean, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., has some green screen issues where you can, you know, I mean, it's really hard to do green screen without being able to tell that's a green screen. I mean, you see a flying car, it's like, yeah, of course it's green screen.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there's moments like the monster effects are really good. The special effects for the superpowers are really good.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I think Star Wars, again, that's probably why it's a few years out, is because I'm sure they have to get a little bit more technology out of it. But
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Speaking of Star Wars, did you see those leaked photos from the set of Star Wars?
No. I mean, I started to look at them, and then I realized, like, this movie's, like, 2 years away, and this is all set stuff, and it's not what they want us to see. So I immediately shied away from it. There's no way I'm going to be watching or looking at those photos.
Yeah, I had the same. I had the same reaction, and I might even shy away from anything but a trailer. Like, I don't want to see pictures. I don't want to see close-ups. Like, I mean, I realized just last week I was talking about the Batman stuff where we showed, like, they talked about the Batman costume and the reveal for Batman v Superman. But I, for Star Wars, like, I've seen enough J.J. Abrams movies that I trust him as far as, you know, his skill as a storyteller, as a director. I am sure that they have a lot of very talented people working on Star Wars, and I don't need to know the design of an X-Wing before I see it. Like, I don't even know, need to know if X-Wings are still in Star Wars, you know, 30 years in the future. Like, I just want to see more Star Wars. I know enough that, you know, Harrison Ford, Mark Hamill, and Carrie Fisher are all in it. You know, all the key players are reprising the roles. There are going to be some new roles to fill and take us on a new adventure. That's all I need. I don't care where they're filming. You know, like, I'm happy to hear that there's a lot of physical stuff. You know, like, there's not a lot of green screen sets. There's sets being built, things that are tangible, you know, things that actors can see and touch and lean up against or duck underneath and do all that kind of stuff. But beyond that, I don't want to be spoiled, especially because, like you said, it's so far away. Not my thing. Yeah. You had a fun link that I just shared in the chat room, though, about what J.J. Abrams thinks of the leaked Star Wars shots. Very, very funny. And if you are a Star Wars nerd, then you will get the joke immediately.
Yeah, see, I didn't get the joke. It's been so long since I've watched those Star Wars films, but I did read up and was like, oh, okay, yeah, I need to watch those Star Wars films again.
I thought it was quite clever. Well done, J.J. So,
well, the type of pre-production work that he's doing, I mean, obviously the guy's got to focus on the film, but the way they're handling pre-production, especially with these little jokes and jabs, that obviously it's a high-profile film, there's going to be leaks, but I think it's in good hands, and a lot of people are probably going to be very happy with what J.J. Abrams puts out, because Disney has a lot of money in this project, and there's no way they're going to make a bad Star Wars film. I think it's going to be great. You know, it'll surpass the prequels. It might not surpass your favorite movie from the original trilogy, but man, I think they're going to build a great Star Wars film.
Nostalgia is going to be a hard thing to overcome, but I agree. I think they have enough. Well, they've got three films that've got it right, and they've got, you know, two and a half films that got it wrong. So, you know, there's enough information about what not to do that I'm not really that worried. Yeah. Speaking of sci-fi, though, I actually have been playing WildStar a little bit over the last week, and what little free time I was able to squeak away over the weekend. This is something that Jocelyn had given me for my birthday at the end of April. And through a couple of beta weekends, I was able to touch base on it. But it was funny because I felt bad because I was so excited about this game, and I got it into the beta. And the beta was okay. I mean, it was fun. It was cool to see, but it was not done. And I mean, I understand that it was a beta, but I'm also spoiled by the beta experience in something like Blizzard, where, you know, a Blizzard game where it's really close to finished. There's a lot of back end stuff they tend to be ironing out, but a lot of the visuals are pretty solid, you know, in a new Blizzard game. But WildStar has changed dramatically, even from just a couple of weeks ago. So it officially launched on Tuesday, the 3rd. I was in as a pre-order early start on Saturday with a lot of other people. That caused some server downtime and even a queue of up to 2 hours for some people. I was lucky and I only ever had to wait about 15 or 20 minutes, which, you know, kind of gave me enough time to go get a cup of coffee or whatever and log in and play. I only got to level 3, so I didn't play very long. So first impressions without, you know, really experiencing much content, it looks good. I'm really happy with, you know, the final look of the UI, which was a gripe for a lot of people. There's a few things that I wish I could change about it. But one thing that I know has been strong in the community is that, even in beta, they had released the API for add-ons. So like WoW, you can, you know, load up your favorite add-on from your favorite third party and enable, you know, the ability to move any part of the UI around or change the way that it looks or scale it, that kind of thing. So I might look into some more stuff like that. I still have a lot of problems with the controls, and this is nothing to do with a beta, like pre-beta or pre-launch or launch. It's one of those games where there's dodging involved. Like you have to get out of the way of the attacks of the opposing player, which is new for me for MMOs. Because every other MMO I've played, the dodge is handled by the math, you know, like by what you roll.
Okay.
So you can kind of stand there and just basically shoot stuff. Sometimes in Warcraft, you have to get out of an area effect spell. But for the most part, someone shooting arrows at you is either going to miss you or not, depending on what the computer says. Okay. But in this one, there's telegraphs on the ground. So an enemy might be spitting poison at you, and there's going to be a clear cone or dot or line on the ground that you have to get out of the way of. Pretty similar, I think, to Smite that you've been playing on the Gamers Inn.
True, yeah.
Right? Okay.
It's really fun to be able to dodge on your own. It's different. A lot of MMOs, you're right, do the dice roll, and some people like that and some people don't.
But, right.
It's always nice to try. Guild Wars did a lot of that too. They had an actual dodge button that where you double tapped E or Q.
Yes.
And you would get out of the way.
Well, and that's what this is. And you can even you can even double back too. So if you're a ranged player, you can do a double tap and jump backwards and give more distance between you and the target. So if you've got a laser gun and they've got a sword, you can, you know, win the match. Mm. But the issue that I have is that I'm just not used to that kind of control, and I find myself just wishing that I could use a controller. There is not enough happening as far as buttons to be pressed that your average Xbox 360 controller could not handle. You know, you've got all your directional control, you've got your abilities, you've got like double tap for dodge, and you've even got some items in your bag that you can use, and a special. Like there's more than enough buttons on a controller to handle all of that. There's more than like six spells for Wildstar, but you can never use more than six at a time in your action bar. So, you know, for me, it would be a perfect marriage if they could just do controller support. You'd need a keyboard next to you if you ever wanted to chat with friends or, you know, bring up extensive menus. It would be easier to hit escape and, you know, mouse over menu items, stuff like that. Like certain things would be easier with a mouse and keyboard, but I would argue that the actual gameplay, especially the combat, would be easier for me with a controller. So I'm finding that a little bit janky. And the reason why is that, like, you've got to move quite quickly with your WSAD keys, but then you also have to hit 1, 2, and 3, which are all the same hand. Like there's no alternative, you know, situation for that. Apparently there's some add-ons that help with like sticky targeting and a couple of other things. So I might look into those. My friend John Beck, who's been on the show before, recommended a few of those that I have to look into. But other than that, I'm really enjoying it. I rolled a Granach Warrior on Storm Talon, which is where the AIE guild is calling home on the Exiles side. I really wanted to play Dominion, though, after playing the beta. I find the Dominion characters more interesting to play. So I am going to be rolling a Chua Spellslinger on Aureus, which is another server. And that's where our friend Chinbeard, Bill Duran, is going to be playing with his wife and a few of their friends. So it'd be nice to be able to, you know, roll a Dominion character and have some friends to play with, and potentially also play with AIE, should I choose. Cool. So yeah, I'm enjoying. I played both the Warrior and the Spellslinger in the beta. The only classes I didn't try were Engineer and Medic. Mm-hmm. I tried everything else.
Now, are they doing like something I dislike about MMOs is, and games in general, is when they do, especially with MMOs, because you're signing up for a game that is going to require a subscription to enjoy for longer periods of time. And knowing me, I'll only get a fraction of the time in the first free month. So sometimes I like to actually try the game before I buy it. I know with the Elder Scrolls Online, they didn't have any sort of like guest pass system. Blizzard's really good for offering guest passes for their games. Do you know if WildStar has a guest pass program?
They do, and it's in my inbox right now.
How many do you get of those?
You know what? That's a really good question. I close my mail because I don't like it dinging when I'm on the show. But I'll check afterwards, and I'll tell you. It's probably two.
Yeah, I mean, probably two, I don't know, three. If they're... it's something I'm interested in trying, and it's definitely a game I'd have to give a shot before purchasing.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's an easy play for me right now because, of course, it was given to me as a gift. It comes with a free month. It was a pre-order, so I got a bunch of cool stuff like, you know, housing and other bonus gear, costumes and whatnot that I haven't yet checked out. But that reminds me, I should really try to put a little bit more effort into playing this month because afterwards I'm going to have to start paying for it. Now, I don't have an existing MMO subscription. I haven't subscribed to WoW for at least a year because I just, after I completed level 90, I just realized I didn't have time to raid, which is what Jocelyn wanted to do. So she continued to play and I was just like, well, you know what? I'm going to save myself $15 a month and put it into other things.
Yeah, I haven't had a subscription to an MMO in a long time, and I'm kind of happy about that. Yeah, I haven't played WoW in a long time, and I think WildStar just looks so cool, and everyone's talking about it, and it seems to be fairly good talk as opposed to what happened with Elder Scrolls, where it was very mixed reaction. I know Jocelyn really liked it for the amount of time she played, and I was close, but I was like, you know what? I'm going to have to use like the 2 month rule and see if people are still playing it. And
yeah,
I was hearing it's not doing so hot. So,
yeah. Well, for WildStar, the two things that stand out, I guess the three things that stand out most to me, the art style and the animation is very cartoony. They're not trying to be a simulator. Like it's over the top, you know, everything you do when you jump, when you roll, like when you, you know, get excited or emote, or if you swing a sword, like everything is just completely exaggerated, kind of like almost Looney Tunes style cartoon exaggeration. But the characters are really well designed in terms of like how unique they look. For the most part, I do find that the Exile side tends to be very human looking, but the Dominion side tends to have a little bit more variety. The simple fact that it's a sci-fi MMO sets it apart from so many of the Dungeons and Dragons fantasy-esque stuff that's out there. Obviously, Star Wars, you know, The Old Republic was out, you know, a couple of years ago, and that was cool, but that limited you to, like, the Star Wars universe. This is, you know, a brand new IP. Every time they release a new trailer about the game, I glean something new about what twist they might be making, so I'm excited about that. And I had a final point, and I don't remember what it was. I was going to say three good things about Star Wars or about WildStar, and I can't remember what it was. It's the thing you have to be prepared for. It's unafraid to let you know it's a game. You're never going to forget that you're playing a video game.
You know, it reminds me of Ratchet and Clank, which is a huge win for me.
Yes, absolutely. The guy, a couple of guys that I follow online, Corey Loftus was one. Corey Lynn Hubble is another. There's a few other artists that were involved in the design of WildStar, and their style is unique, but does have a similar aesthetic to the Creature Box guys, who are the guys behind the design for Ratchet and Clank. And it's bright colors. It's like I said, it's very cartoony. I would argue that it's a pretty apt description. But like, for example, in this MMO, this, you know, immersive world, when you level up, the level you just turned flashes over your head, a heavy metal song plays, and an announcer goes, "Oh shit, you leveled up!" But they bleep the shit. Like, he doesn't actually swear. It's really over the top. I mean, it's fun, but I mean, if you're kind of trying to be super serious about role-playing, it does kind of take you out of it.
It's very Call of Duty of them.
Yeah. One of the things that I find really interesting is that they use the advantage of being a sci-fi MMO in that you never have to go back to turn in quests, or not often. Okay. Well, you've got a device that, like a cell phone or a data pad, that lets you talk to the people that you are working for. So when you're done, you just kind of beep them and go, "I'm done." And they go, "Okay."
So, I mean, unless it's going to trigger a cutscene, I mean, why not just have a conversation via like a walkie-talkie?
And the cutscenes are the instances where you have to go back to a specific location where someone is like turning on a machine or, you know, waking up another character. Like those kind of situations, you do have to go back to the character where you got the quest in the first place. But if it's just like, you know, go kill three of these things, they'll say, "Hey, thanks for doing that. Why don't you go on down the road and talk to my buddy at the next camp and he'll give you something else to do." And you're like, "Okay, sweet. Cause I don't really want to walk all the way back to where you are." You know, like it's the things that kind of turn your 2 hours, you know, you get an hour to set aside to play a game, and it, it allows you to do two or three quests as opposed to one, you know, or two that you would have to take a long time. But anyway, I digress. Cause I'm obviously excited about getting into it. It's still overwhelming. Some of the, to at least have one criticism in there. There's a lot of things that pop up at the same time. Carbine did not learn from a lot of the people complaining about it in the beta. And that is, there's just too much text popping up, overlapping all at the same time. In addition to audio from NPCs that are saying something completely different than what's in the balloon. And you just, the human brain can only read so much at a time. And I find that the balloons pop up and go way too fast. Now, I'm a slow reader, so, I mean, that's just me. But it really feels like Times Square for the first, well, so far the first three levels. I've not had a break yet. When Joe Wright and I were playing in the beta, we were getting to the point up into level 7, 8, 9. In our characters, where we were starting to have our profession and our paths start having missions available. So in addition to picking up quests from NPCs, just the world in general would say, hey, it's time for a soldier quest, or hey, it's time for an explorer quest. And we'd be trying to talk over Skype, and we couldn't get through a sentence without something blinging up in our face and, you know, requesting our attention. And it felt very overwhelming, and we weren't really a fan. So I'm curious to see, as I get up past like just these first three levels, how it handles, you know, all that kind of stuff, and whether I can easily manage it or at least turn off some of the notifications.
Well, yeah, and let's hope that as it goes on, I mean UI is always something that's refined over time, like as they get time, you know, because they're always focused on, you know, the big content stuff, right? And then eventually they trim down the UI to make it much more usable.
Right on. Well, we're already kind of approaching an hour, and we haven't even touched on Game of Thrones yet, which is, you know, something that Ryan and I are famous for, I guess. But this week in our Winter is Coming Season 4 section, we are going to be spoiling the crap out of Episode 8, which just happened on Sunday night. So if you have not yet seen The Mountain and the Viper, please disregard this section of the podcast until you have seen it, because Ryan and I are going to talk about all kinds of spoilery stuff, and we would not want to ruin this epic episode for you. As a quick plot summary, unexpected visitors arrive in Mole's town. Littlefinger's motives are questioned. Ramsay tries to prove himself to his father, and Tyrion's fate is decided. So, I don't know, general thoughts. I think for me, well, why don't we just start with the big elephant in the room?
Right.
So the big fight at the end, which is the title of the episode, The Mountain and the Viper, is the trial by combat of Gregor Clegane versus Oberyn Martell, the Prince of Dorne. So the Mountain and the Viper, or the Red Viper, as they call him in the show. And this was a really interesting fight.
Yeah.
There was a lot of twirling, and there was a lot of monologuing by Oberyn Martell, and having even read the books, like I knew what happened, but the show did a really good job of keeping me on the edge of my seat, wondering when it was all going to go down
or how.
Yeah. Which I believe, and I'll get to that in a second, it was different than the books. But I mean, obviously, you know, the Viper loses after being too cocky and dancing around the mountain, and ultimately winning. I mean, he had him. He hooks his calf and rips out his leg. He stabs him through the chest with a giant spear, has him on his back, and it's just, he is one swift stroke of putting that spear through the forehead of this guy and killing him. And winning, but he wants a confession. He wants the Mountain to confess to raping and murdering his sister, and he also wants him to implement Tywin Lannister as the one who gave the order to raid the city and do all the pillaging and all the damage. And he doesn't get it, because he gets too close to the Mountain. The Mountain trips him, knocks him to the ground, grabs him by the neck, in one punch, knocks out all of his teeth. At least all the front teeth. So he's lying on his back, dazed by the hit. The Mountain rolls over on top of him and puts his thumbs through his eye sockets the whole time that Oberyn is screaming bloody murder, which I was just brutal. Like, I mean, that it chilled my bones to hear this scream. So, I mean, excellent, you know, crazy fear acting on the part of, what's his name? Pedro Pascal, the guy that plays Oberyn. But, and then the mountain confesses loudly that, yeah, he raped his sister. Yeah, he killed her. He crushed her skull just like this. And then he pops the Prince of Dorne like a pimple.
Yeah.
He just squeezes the guy's head until everything just kind of goes. And it was the most violent thing I have seen on Game of Thrones to date. And that's saying something.
Yeah, it's probably the first time I've seen a show that isn't like a crappy B-horror film where they took, you know what, that Mortal Kombat fatality would fit really well here, you know? I haven't read the books, and this has been a theme whenever I'm on. I haven't read the books, but I knew he wasn't going to win. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've wised up to Game of Thrones. I'm not, you know, fool me once, you know.
shame on you.
Ned Stark, shame on you. Fool me twice, Red Wedding, shame on me. But now, oh, I'm on to you. So I'm like, okay, he's going to die. He's not going to win, or at the very least, he's going to die. He may win, but he's going to lose in the end. And when he was yelling during the battle, I thought, man, dude, I know you want a confession, but you're coming on a little strong here. And then he stabs him in the chest, and it's like, oh, okay, he's going to win. And then he's yelling at him, and he's walking around like he's a, you know, he's a rooster, you know, talking to his hands, you know, like, hey, you killed my, you can't, this isn't a video podcast, but I'm bobbing my head. It's like, you killed my sister. You killed my nephews and nieces. You know, who gave you the order? And he looks away. He looks up at Tywin. And the second I saw, I was like, the mountain's going to do something and trips him. And as soon as he went down, I was like, well, it's over. It's just a matter of how terrible it being over is going to be.
Yeah.
And I did not see this coming. At all. Like,
yeah.
I'm glad I didn't spoil this for myself because I feel like I was watching reaction videos because that seems to be a thing ever since the Ned Stark bit is that people, like, they see on the internet that this is a crazy episode, so they stick a camera up somewhere when they're watching this one at the very end and they get this, you know, raw reaction. And when I was watching those reaction videos, you can hear the clip being played over and over again. I started to get sick to my stomach because I could picture what was happening.
Yeah.
And you're right, that scream is inhuman, you know, like,
yeah.
Good for them for getting that really, like, my eyes are being crushed in scream from this guy without actually crushing his eyes in.
I think there's two things that make this so scary. The first is that they pulled a Walking Dead where you get to see, through some very cool special effects, the mountain put his thumbs through Oberyn's eyes. Mm-hmm. You hear him scream at him and that he's going to crush his head. They cut away when he pops his skull. They don't show the actual event, but they give you the sound. Mm-hmm. And your brain, your imagination fills in the rest, and then they show you the aftermath of the two of them lying on the stone ground with, you know, Oberyn's brains everywhere. And I mean, like, it's just enough that you just put it all together in your head and it completely flips you out. The other thing that I couldn't put my finger on it until earlier today when I was just, you know, this image in my head has just been there since, you know, Monday night when Jocelyn and I watched the show.
It's gross.
It's gross. It's really gross. But the thing is, it's like for all their spinning, for all their talent, for all their swords and crossbows and all the things that they have, he killed them with thumbs,
yep.
Which is something that everybody on the planet has and anybody could do to you. And that's what freaks me out about it, is that this is something that anybody could do. And it almost irks me out because, like, I've, in terms of real life, because I've recently seen some stories in the news where some idiot people are reenacting things they've seen online and some people are getting hurt. And I'm waiting for somebody that's just not right in the head, some serial killer out there, to start killing people by poking their eyes out. Like, it feels like it's something that could and will happen in real life sometime, and it just makes my skin crawl.
Well, the thing is that he could have snapped his neck. Like, he had that opportunity when he was choking him after, like, let's not skip over the fact that he he punched his teeth out and you heard chiclets hit the floor.
Yep.
It was, that was just, that's like experiencing that nightmare where you lose all your teeth all in like 5 seconds.
Yeah.
And the way he looks like, you know, Oberon's just like, oh shit. And he's got no teeth. He looks like grandpa without his dentures in, mm-hmm. and he's screaming like it's so well done the way they set up these effects shots. And I mean, we haven't seen something so chilling since Daenerys' brother got that gold poured on top of him.
Yeah.
Like, that was a similar scene where it was done so well, and the way he screamed as this scalding hot gold, you know, melted gold, like,
boiled his brain.
Melted his skull.
Yeah.
And, like, brain, and cooked his brain, yeah.
Yeah.
It's just, your imagination goes wild, and you're right, sound just certainly makes your brain start ticking in the wrong ways. It's...
Yeah.
It's, ugh, ugh. Yeah. I don't like, and then, you know, right after the episode ends, you know people on the internet are like, it's a common thread of the people who've read the books, like, just you wait.
Yeah.
It's like, what, you said that about the Red Wedding and you're telling me to wait? Like, come on, like, this is as big as, you crushed a man's head, you know,
with, like, your bare hands. Yeah,
like, that's the top. George R. R. Martin, if he can top that, he is a psychopath.
Yeah. Absolutely. The thing that I could not reconcile, because I don't remember exactly how it happened in the books, but I was talking with Chad on Twitter, and I feel like it's not that he crushes his skull. I think at some point, it's a similar situation where Oberon is monologuing, the mountain is down, but somehow the mountain gets a hold of him, and mm-hmm. I think he crushes him in a bear hug. Like, I think he breaks his back and his ribs and all of his internal organs, and things just kind of squeeze out everywhere. Like, I think that's how it happens in the book. If you're listening to this and you know I'm wrong, then email me at thecitadelcafe@gmail.com and let me know. But it was similar but different. I feel like I would have remembered him popping his head.
Yeah. Oh, man. Ugh. Yeah.
But on a lighter note, on Twitter, there was a Instagram picture floating around, or at least another Twitter snap of Pedro Pascal and, God, I can't even pronounce his first name, but Julius Bronson, who plays Clegane, hanging out, you know, going, like, they're on the beach, you know, relaxing, you know, offset in Game of Thrones, saying, like, hey, don't worry, folks, we're friends in real life. And something that was abundantly clear in that picture is that Bronson is 6'9", and I looked this up, he's 420 pounds. So 6'9", and 420. So they're really not doing a lot of camera tricks to make this guy look really, really big.
Yeah.
And Pascal is 5'11". Like, he's not a short guy. But judging from the picture, he is not 420 pounds. He's pretty slim. He's pretty slim, but I was impressed because I was expecting, you know, not a lot of male actors are super tall, but I mean, like, he's only an inch shorter than I am.
Yeah, man, and the size of the mountain. Although I hear he's a really nice guy in real life.
Oh,
and he looks like a nice guy.
I'm sure they're both very nice guys.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But it feels like most of the time when you see these giant bodybuilders, you just assume that they're dicks. And
well, yeah.
Like, he looks like a nice guy.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. One of the things that I'm going to share in the chat room here is a video from Gizmodo. Somebody fixed the Red Viper versus Mountain fight for Game of Thrones, and they made it kind of out like a 90s action movie fight. Obviously, these people are fans of the Viper because they switched it so that the Viper wins. But it's pretty funny. If you have a chance to check out this video that Joss sent me, there's reasons as to why they did it, and there's little music changes and explaining what the shot is. You know, there's the gratuitous slow motion shot and all this kind of stuff. It's really quite well done, and it's good for a laugh if you're a fan of like 90s action movies.
Yeah, I thought it was really well done, that video, and it's kind of like you could do a video like that for every single one of these. You know, I'm sure there was one done for Ned Stark's, you know, head being chopped off where it was just like a Wayne's World. And then, like, they just flash back to a scene where he wakes up all oh, that was a bad dream.
Yeah, yeah. Wakes up in the brothel, like, what did Littlefinger put in my drink?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. Well, I guess we can kind of move on to some of the other story points in the episode. What did you think of the conversation between Tyrion and Jaime in the cell just before the trial?
Yeah, you know, I found it really hard to pay attention to this episode, knowing that the conclusion was the fight. And the way I was kind of like trying to think of how to structure my notes, and the best example, I love metaphors, but the best example I could come up with is like paying for UFC pay-per-view and just socializing with your friends until the title match. I mean, no one wants to watch these scrawny people run around and slap each other. They want to see the heavyweights go at it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that being said, that does like sort of, you know, literally slap the people in the face of this episode, because it was a really good episode. It wasn't just the last 15 minutes that was amazing. I thought that, seeing what could be Tyrion's final moments in his prison, talking to his brother, like, man, they're just really trying to sell Jaime as a good guy. And it almost makes you forget that he's screwing his sister and
pushed a six-year-old out a window.
I'm almost at the point where I'm forgiving him for pushing that kid out the window. I mean, he pushed him out the window, and now he can like enter animals' minds. I think Jaime did him a favor.
Yeah, yeah. No, whether or not he could have done that with, you know, like without that event, I don't
True.
Know.
True. I don't know. Well, yeah. Like, I guess. I mean, I doubt him being paralyzed allowed him to unlock that special skill, but it certainly set him down a path where he had to unlock it.
Right. Well, now he has no choice, right? It's the only it's the only opportunity he has to move around now, having known, you know, his legs his whole life. You know, now that he's he's
but
paralyzed.
I don't know. I felt like as Tyrion's final moment and having that heart to heart with his brother, the acting was really well done, in the sense that, you know, I have three brothers. I mean, one of us has never been on death row for a trial by combat, but you know, it feels like that conversation that they had was very brotherly, and you could tell that they love each other. You know, they have that brotherly connection, and they're both very sad that, you know, they may not see each other again, and they're reminiscing about, you know, like they have a common thread with this cousin who wasn't, you know, was. What do you say? Dropped by the nurse.
Dropped on his head by the nurse. Yeah.
Yeah, and just crushes beetles, and they have partly this conversation that's a little depressing, but also kind of, you know, funny in a way how they're reflecting on this cousin who could do nothing but.
Well, and the story too. Sounds. I mean, I found it a foreshadowing. Eventually, they were talking about their father. You know, eventually they're talking about basically. The one that can crush the beetles crushes the beetles, and that's the only thing that they do, is because that's what they want to do, crush beetles. I mean, like, it's essentially what Tywin is doing. I mean, anybody that he gets in his way under his boot, he just puts the boot down and squishes them.
Yeah. You know? And I mean, Tywin is also a kind of person who may not set up everybody's downfall, but is certainly happy when it's like, oh, that domino knocked itself over. That's great. Like with, you know, with Tywin and the Viper, and maybe even the Mountain to a certain extent. I mean, we don't know his fate in this episode, and maybe they won't even touch on it in this season. I don't know. This show is very straightforward. Like, they don't leave a lot of, like, you know, hanging story bits, except for maybe the White Walkers.
But. Yeah, they don't do a lot of cliffhanger stuff on episode 10. It all tends to be episode like 8, 9, and then 10 tends to be a wrap up. There's a story continuation, you know, someone sails off into the distance, you don't know where they're going, or I'm trying to think about something else, you know, they pull out to a shot of a dragon flying that you've never seen, or like that kind of stuff they'll do in the episode 10 to kind of say, oh, we're moving forward in this direction for next season. But they don't do like a, you know, will Tyrion be dead when you come back next year? Like they don't. Like, this wasn't the finale. Like, if this was the finale in season 10, like, that would be, or in episode 10, that would be insane. Like, to make people wait all that long to find out what happens to Tyrion, like, you're right, it's a very straightforward show. They tend to move through that stuff pretty quickly.
But that's what's so great about the show, is that they don't adhere to the tropes of television where, you know, the cliffhanger moment that any other show would use as a rating boost on the final episode, like, even Marvel of S.H.I.E.L.D. was kind of guilty of this. There was a lot of, like, you know, loose ends that weren't tied up, and it's like, well, tune in next year when we, and I mean, it's network television, so you got the ability to only have to wait 4 months as opposed to 8 with Game of Thrones, but Game of Thrones is like, no, I mean, we're definitely going to leave you with, you know, I can't wait for the next season. But they do it without cheap-shotting it, you know? Like, they wrap up this season. I mean, I predict that, of course, we're going to find out where Tyrion is going to go, whether he is put to death or whether he walks away and, you know, tells a little joke. I don't know.
What's your prediction?
Oh, man, like, I think, like, the internet has ruined it for me in the sense that, again, like, just memes, because there's, like, I could be wrong, and I don't even know if I should say it, because it seems spoilery, but there's a picture of George R. R. Martin holding, like, a piece of paper that says, you know, stop complaining or Tyrion's next, you know? And
oh, I see.
You know what I mean? And I don't think Tyrion is that one character that is impervious to the Game of Thrones rule set, but I don't think he goes in this season. I think he dies eventually, and it will be a heroic death. I don't think he's put to death. But then again, boy, would that be a very Game of Thrones thing to do, for him to be put to death. But they already did that with Ned Stark, you know?
Right.
I also feel like this show and the author is not one to do things twice.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. And I it's so hard to make a prediction.
And that's the sign of a good TV show. Like, when you don't know when a character is safe from the very get-go, like when you know, people are going in there thinking Sean Bean is going to be Sean Bean's show. This is going to be the Ned Stark show. This is going to be great. Oh, nope, he's dead. Oh, crap. Okay. like, that just puts you on the edge of your chair. Like, whenever somebody is near, you know, the edge of the moon door, or whenever, you know, there's a jousting match, or there's a battle, or, like, you just, I mean, it made the Red Wedding that much more shocking for people, because they got behind Rob and they're like, well, his father died and now he's going to be the Prince Charming that, you know, saves, like, restores his father's good name. Nope.
Yeah.
Like, just, I think it's a mark of a good show. The Walking Dead has that ability, I find, where you just don't know which one of these, you know, ensemble cast members is going to make it to the end of the episode and which is, you know, who are not.
But they're guilty of it. You know, like, Walking Dead is not without its blemishes when it comes to that sort of, like, rule set. Like, Game of Thrones, yeah, anybody can go. I believe that. After Robb Stark, I fully believe that.
Oh, I find that Walking Dead is guilty of filling time. Like, they'll have the three things they want to happen this episode, and if they don't happen next to one another, then they fill it in with, like, three episodes of boring crap.
Like,
you know?
Yeah, like, with Walking Dead, like, my opinion is, like, they are producers of a hit TV show first and telling a great story second.
Yep.
Game of Thrones is telling a great story. And with Walking Dead, you know, Rick's not going to die unless that actor throws a hissy fit and walks away, which, if he hasn't done it yet, he's smart enough to stick around and cash those checks. I mean, look at Daryl, like, that character, you know, he's not going anywhere. He was supposed to die in the first season, and they literally said, well, the people liked them, so we kept him around, and we felt it would we could do better stories with him. But... and maybe that's true, but still, it's like they've changed their tune. And some would argue that, well, if Daryl died, we wouldn't got this, and this. And that's true. We do have some great Daryl stories, but that it's they're TV producers first and telling a great story.
Yeah, that's a good call.
Not to say that Walking Dead doesn't have a great story. I love the Walking Dead story.
Yeah, no, but we need to catch up. We're always pressed for time. There's always something that seems to grab our attention before we think to catch up on the Walking Dead.
Mm-hmm.
As far as you know, dead people, Arya and the Hound arrive at the Blood Gates, which is the entrance to the Eyrie, only to find out that Lysa Arryn was apparently not thrown, but committed suicide out the moon door not 2 days ago. And the only reaction is a blank stare from the Hound and maniacal laughter from Arya as it echoes throughout the mountains. It killed me. It was probably one of my favorite moments this season.
Yeah.
I find that Arya developing this morbid sense of humor about what's fun, what she wants to do with her life, and what she finds funny is incredibly amusing. I'm looking forward to a lot more as she gets older and a little bit more I guess, I mean, I'm expecting more robust with the sword. She's already started killing people pretty deftly. So I think it's going to be some fun, some fun times ahead. And this is going to, I think, going to remind us of the, like 90s action movies, like with one-liners.
You know? Yeah. And that's one, that's a partnership that we have no idea. Like, I kind of feel like obviously Arya and the Hound like have this, this certain hate towards each other, but they also have this kinship because they've survived on the road for so long, and the Hound's blank stare and Arya laughing. Like, I don't know how that ends. I don't know if maybe the Hound's like, ugh, great, walks away. I mean, he can certainly defend himself and you know, make a living without Arya's pocket, but at least he would have been able to retire by selling off Arya. But I mean, there's that being said, there's no way of telling whether he'll actually, he won't get his coin anyways, just because his niece is dead. I mean, they don't know that her older sister and also Littlefinger are there. So,
well, and a couple hundred feet away, like it's not far from the Bloodgate to the area. Like that's kind of like the first line of defense.
Yeah. So, and I mean, Martin, the only issue is that they don't know that it's Sansa.
Right. Like the guards down there don't have no idea. I mean, and really it's only been just this episode that Sansa revealed herself to the small council that was convening on the death of the Lady of the Land, you know, shortly after her marriage to Littlefinger, which they obviously deem suspicious because Littlefinger has a reputation. And it isn't until Sansa walks in and sets the record straight by lying, you know, to protect Littlefinger, that, you know, we get to see kind of Sansa up her game. Like, she doesn't, I mean, the analogy that I feel is pretty apt is that she's no longer a pawn in the Game of Thrones. Like, people were just kind of using her and moving her around and using her as leverage and, you know, exploiting her for the first 3.5 seasons of the show. And now she's gone from a pawn to more of a rook. Like, she's still far enough away from the action that she's not really doing much, but she's moving positions. Like, she's moving back and forth, you know, while looking on things from outside. And I think twofold, like, she understands the political gain of protecting Littlefinger, and that he obviously cares for her and wants to protect her. So, and not to sound funny, but being a woman in the world of Games of Thrones, probably a good idea to have a dude protecting you unless you're Brienne. But then secondly, she's kind of getting that idea of the power that she has over Littlefinger, which is just her womanhood. Like, he wants her. So if he's probably not going to force himself on her. So if she can at least dangle that, you know, that in front of him, she might be able to get some things that she wants out of the situation. And I'm not saying it's necessarily good to see this side of Sansa, but it's at least as good to see her sticking up for herself, taking steps to protect herself. And then there was a little bit of a corny thing at the end where she had like basically a costume change. She's dressing like an adult as opposed to dressing like a little girl now.
And I found that a little bit weird. With her at the very end, it was she's doing the opposite that Arya is doing. Like, Arya is very taking the Ned Stark warrior path to revenge, whereas Sansa's like, okay, I guess I better take this path, and if that includes like getting into this royal dress and, you know, now they know she's basically royalty, and she's way more capable of ruling the Vale than that weird kid who will probably end up through the Moon Door anyways. But it sounds like, you know, they're going to try and turn him into a king. But isn't it weird that they said, like, you could marry, I mean, it was the previous episode, but they talked about, like, Sansa being his queen. Like, wouldn't that be, like, they're like cousins, right? Like blood cousins.
Yes. I don't think that really stops many people in Game of Thrones. But yeah, you're right. They're cousins. That's true. Yeah.
Well, hopefully that doesn't happen.
Yeah. Right on. Any final thoughts on the episode? There's a couple of other story points, but I'm just curious as to what kind of sticks out for you.
No, I mean, really, it was just about waiting around for that matchup. I mean, but it was sort of out of left field for Jorah to sort of disappear. Like, that's probably the one thing, the other thing that happened in this episode where it just, out of left field, like, we're just going to send this guy away now. And I was like, well, okay.
Yeah.
So he's off on his own. Like, I mean, I don't, again, I don't know what they do with that for this show because it's not like...
And I don't know either because it was different in the books. She found out about the betrayal before she took Marine, and the infiltration of Marine through the sewers was led by Jorah Mormont because she basically relegated him down to the dirty job because she found out about the betrayal. And so she keeps him around because she decides to keep him close so she can keep an eye on him. But he's like forever out of her trust. Like she casts him aside as far as he's in the camp with the Unsullied and stuff, but he's not at his previous position. So I don't know what they're going to do. And I would almost argue that this is going to be more interesting. I like the character and I would like to see what he does, you know, and whether he like if he's supposed to come back and win her trust back, how he does that.
Yeah. I think that obviously they're sending him away for him to kind of come back and be like, I did something great for you, and at least to get allowed back into the cool club. But I guess he probably won't ever reach that moment. I mean, he's betrayed her, you know, this one time, and I mean, she's not too happy about that. So.
Oh, yeah, she's pissed. He's also got the option of going back to Westeros now that he's pardoned. I mean, the pardon is real.
Yeah.
So there's that too. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what might happen there.
It's hard to tell. Like, did we see that signing of the pardon? Like, because I was trying to remember. Like, ooh. Baratheon.
All of these things happened really quickly in season one and season two. They definitely showed Jorah spying and sending a message through a little boy back to Varys. But you had to be paying attention to the secondary conversations at both sides of the fence. So Daenerys would be talking with somebody and then Jorah would say something subtle or do something subtle that you'd have to be paying attention to. Same thing. There'd be a King's Council meeting and Varys would say something explaining his little birds are everywhere or something like that. And he would hint at, you know, it was Jorah or somebody that knew about Daenerys' whereabouts, etc. And I feel like it was Varys and some other information throughout the series that kind of led to the puzzle, or not the puzzle, but the information that you pieced together as to why Jorah was not disbanded, but banned from Westeros by Ned Stark, by the way. It was because he was selling and trafficking slaves, as ironic as that is now that he's working with Daenerys, or was working with Daenerys. And that his dad is the old bear at the wall who died last season. The Lord Commander Mormont, that's his father.
Oh.
And if I remember correctly, the reason that the Lord Commander takes over at the wall is because his only living and heir son, Jorah, was a fuck-up. Like, he screwed up and got banished so that he couldn't inherit the Mormont kind of family heritage, so that the old bear, being so close like to the end of his life, thought, well, I'm just going to go to the wall, screw this noise. So I think as far as I remember, it's been a long time since I've read book two, definitely some interesting, I guess, opportunities for the Mormonts, I guess, as things kind of unravel. I want to say unfold, but they're just, it's more like spiral at this point. Yeah, especially because not only does Jorah follow and love Daenerys as a queen, but he's in love with her. Like, he obviously wants to be with her.
Yeah, so. That's true. Like, and I mean, she has no interest. There was a lot of like relationship type stuff in this episode with, you know, the dude without the naked bits watching the girl with the naked bits.
Like, no, yes,
the very start, which was
Grey Worm,
which was a little weird and kind of like, why are they showing us this? You know, it'll be interesting to see where that goes, but, just seemed like, I don't know if that's in the books, but it also seemed like just,
I don't recall.
They're settling in. So the relationships start to percolate because they are literally like, we're going to stay here and rule.
Yeah. They're going to be in Marine for a little while. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know what you mean. Be interesting to see what happens with Daenerys and, I can't remember his name. He's the
Chuck-looking guy.
Yeah, the guy that was in her bedroom last episode. Oh, Dario Naharis. That's
his name. I like him.
Yeah, I mean, I like him too. He's charismatic and he's obviously a good fighter and he's, you know, fighting for her, you know, for her love and her approval and all this kind of stuff. He seems like he has just and good intentions, but we'll see how that goes. But it'll be interesting to see that they have the time for that relationship to develop, like you said. Mm-hmm. So, right on. Well, let's wrap things up here with the Internet Minute. This is sponsored by Tweaked Audio. We are proudly sponsored by the folks over at tweakedaudio.com. They provide you with high-performance noise-reducing earbuds. We provide you with a offer code. If you enter the code TCC at checkout, you will get free shipping and 30% off of your fancy new earbuds. So head on over to tweakedaudio.com and check them out. My pick this week is something pretty quick. It's actually a Kickstarter book project. It's called Snorfles and Meeps, and it's kind of hard to explain, but if you follow the link that I'm throwing in the chat room or in the show notes, you'll find out very quickly that it is an art book put together by Steph Labaris and Janine Schaefer. They are both illustrators and designers working in animation and the gaming industries. And every year they combine their individual personal work into this cute art book, which is mostly like, you know, cute creatures, animals, fuzzies and stuff like that. And where are they on their Kickstarter? They are $6,800 towards their $10,000 goal with only 8 days to go. And I am going to be interviewing Steph and Janine tomorrow night on Comics Coast to Coast. So hopefully we will be able to get that interview out to you quite quickly, so with still a lot of time left on the clock for the Kickstarter. But if you like art and if you like furry creatures that are very well drawn, then check out Snorfles and Meeps. So that's an N with an apostrophe. Volume 3 on Kickstarter, and check out some of the cool, rewards, backing rewards. They've got lots of examples of their work up on the site, and I've spoken to them so far only via email. They seem like really fun ladies to hang out and talk art with, so I'm looking forward to the interview tomorrow night on Comics Coast to Coast. I will tweet out when all that has hit the interwebs. Ryan, what's your pick this week?
Well, the internet has been taken by storm this week by Nintendo, of all companies, with their Mario Kart 8 meme that I'm sure they didn't do on purpose, called the Luigi Death Stare. And I like to say Reddit has sort of had fun with this, but I feel the whole internet's getting in on the fun. And basically in Mario Kart, when you take out another player, they've built into the to the game that when you pass that character who's like now like writhing on the road trying to get their cart under control because they got hit with a red shell, your character looks at them, makes a reaction, all the while speeding along, crossing the finish line, and, you know, winning the cup. So in Luigi's case, he just has this stone cold sort of like angry look where he's like, if that red shell hadn't hit you, I would have stabbed you. And it all started with him taking out Waluigi, which is his, made up arch nemesis in the Nintendo universe. But it's sort of expanded from there, and people have added like music remixes and just had a lot of fun with it. And I mean, Nintendo's just sitting here like, and I haven't seen Nintendo react yet. I hope they don't squash it, because they've been known to squash good things that do well for them. But I'm hoping they run with it, and they really like, they embrace this quirkiness that just, they, I'm sure they didn't mean to happen. Maybe it produces some positive results for them. But the link that I put in here is sort of like a collection of some of the better ones. Cool. And they're worth watching for sure.
Yeah, I'm looking at the previews for them now, and some of them look pretty funny. There's one here where someone's made the eyes glow.
Yeah. They've had some fun with it, and I'm sure it'll... I mean, it's just perfect timing. I mean, with E3 next week, Nintendo couldn't have been, you know, had a better opportunity to use Mario Kart 8 to kind of, like, get Nintendo and the Wii U, for that matter, on people's, you know, browser windows. And with E3 next week, it just helps them even further, because people are going to be looking for games news starting Monday and Tuesday next week with the press conferences.
Right.
So I'm actually looking for... I unfortunately have to work, but considering they're on the West Coast, most of these are taking place in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
With starting with Microsoft at noon Eastern on Monday, then going to EA, Ubisoft, and Sony, and then Nintendo having their sort of digital event on Tuesday at noon.
Right.
And I'm really looking forward to seeing what all these companies have to offer in 2014. I'm not everything's been pushed to 2015. I'm sure you saw the Batman thing. Mm-hmm. It's a little disappointing.
Yeah.
So I want to know what's coming out in 2014 to look forward to.
Yeah, really though. I'm willing to wait for a good game.
Oh, of course.
But it is disappointing when people get your hopes up and then they change the release dates on things. Yeah. And also, I mean, sometimes a little bit concerning. I mean, obviously they're taking the time to fix problems, but if there's a higher up problem, like a corporate problem with like release dates or funding or something like that, then you kind of go, oh God, like I hope someone isn't taking control of an otherwise good game, delaying it and making it crappy.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And I agree with you. I mean, Nintendo's done this a few times with their games. I think Mario Kart was supposed to launch early 2014 and a game before that was supposed to launch in the fall. So. Yeah.
Nintendo was also supposed to have some good games on the Wii U, but I haven't seen that yet either.
Well, Mario Kart 8 is fantastic, and it's probably the first game to come out on the system that's truly been like, yeah, if this is the game that probably is going to push people out there, I think it needs maybe one more for people to be like, I got to buy this system.
Probably a Zelda title.
Probably. I mean, we'll find out at E3.
Do you find that it's really next-gen graphics with Mario Kart 8?
I would say yes. The people who look at the teraflops and the CPU gigahertz and all that fun stuff, I'm sure they look at it and it's like, that's not next gen. Next gen is the PS4 AMD quad core 4 processor horse thingamajigger. I don't care about numbers. I don't care about graphic. I don't care about the tech. All I care about is that it looks great. The Wii was underpowered and kind of a piece of shit, especially when you hooked it up to an HD television set.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But the Wii U, when you get the right game and the right amount of polish and love is put into it, like Mario Kart 8, like any of the Nintendo games, you get a really good looking HD game.
Mm-hmm.
That's not to say that, you know, it could have been done better on the Microsoft and Sony platforms, but really where it comes right down to it is like if you try to do photorealistic on the Wii U, yes, it's going to show that this is not as powerful. But when you go with a stylized look like similar to Mario Kart 8, mm-hmm. that looks like a next-gen game.
Yeah. I think that's the thing that I like so much about WildStar is that because they've chosen a cartoony art style, they're able to render very cool lighting and textures on things that are not real proportions. And you as a player are more forgiving versus, you know, trying to create very realistic looking people and just having that uncanny valley missing the mark kind of effect. And I think that's something that I enjoy more in my video games. I draw the line at Batman. I find that I like the realism that Batman has been giving me. But as far as like, you know, platformers and other fun games that have that kind of stuff into it, like I like the Ratchet and Clanks and you know, the Mario Karts and that sort of stuff, you know, for consoles. A really good example is the Transformers series, the Fall of Cybertron and War of Cybertron series for Xbox 360. Those were a really good mix of fun kind of comic booky design, realistic laser effects and stuff like that. But still, you know, transforming was exaggerated and made a lot of noise. And, you know, when you blew up, you flew all over the place, and like that kind of stuff I thought was really entertaining and was a good game. Like it didn't have to be, I didn't want it to look like Michael Bay's Transformers, you know, like when you transform into a vehicle, it's okay if it's a space truck. Like I, you know, I don't need it to look like a specific, you know, I don't need Bumblebee to look like a Camaro or whatever. It was pretty good. So right on. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of the Citadel Cafe. We record live every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern on thecitadelcafe.com/live. The mobile stream is provided by alphageekradio.com. If you'd like to pay them a visit, check them out and drop Todd a line and let them know how good the stream is doing. We really appreciate the effort that Todd and the folks over there put into keeping the mobile stream up and operational. Music for the show was composed by Kevin MacLeod, and of course, this episode will be available on demand via iTunes and our website, thecitadelcafe.com, where you can also find the show notes and the links to all the cool stuff that I've talked about with Ryan tonight. Email the show at thecitadelcafe.com and tell us about all the stuff that we got wrong, including the email address, which is thecitadelcafe@gmail.com, not just the website. Find us by name on Twitter or on Facebook. My name is Joel Duggan. You can find everything I am doing online at joelduggan.com, including a brand new t-shirt and a brand new print. I've taken a popular dragon image that I find sells very well at cons and made the 11x17 and 9x12 prints available on my website, as well as a t-shirt from Slash Loot. So if you go to joelduggan.com right now, check out the t-shirt in the store, and if you like it, then pick it up, because I think it'd be really fun to have a lot of friends with a puking dragon on their chest.
Mm-hmm.
Just something that amuses me to no end.
It's a cool design, for sure.
Thanks. You can also follow me on Twitter with just my name, Joel Duggan. Ryan, what are you up to on the Gamers Inn?
How's Jocelyn feeling?
She's feeling better. She's awesome. She's not 100%, but she is on the mend. She just got back from volleyball, so she's playing volleyball, sir.
She can talk about video
games. I think she's going to be able to talk about some video games with you.
That's awesome. Well, Jocelyn's been on the mend for a couple weeks, so I'm glad to hear that she'll be back in the hosting chair for Friday and Thursday with our Gamers in Game Night. I think we're doing a throwback with Mass Effect 3 Thursday at 8 o'clock, twitch.tv/thegamersin. Or twitch.tv/GISGamer. But on Friday, probably going to be taking it easy, finding out what Jocelyn's been doing for game-wise in the last 2 weeks, and probably doing predictions for E3, which is next week.
Always fun.
You can find that at gamersinpodcast.com. We're live Friday night at 8:30. But I also wanted to give a quick plug to Zombies Ate My Podcast, which I'm off to next to record. We actually did an episode with Scott Johnson last week, which was a highlight for my career as a podcaster. I mean, you sit there listening to Extra Life Radio like 8 years ago thinking like, man, podcasts are really cool. Mm-hmm. And then now you get to do an episode with him. And it was a lot of fun. And I think he had a lot of fun. We talked about Walking Dead season 4, full on spoiler mode. So you might want to catch up before you listen, but you can find that at zombiesatemypodcast.com.
Nice. Where can people find you online, though?
Oh, me personally. Well, yeah. If you
can't forget about you.
Yeah, no. I mean, I got to pimp myself, right? You can follow me on Twitter at rmurphy or go to my website, ryanmurphy.ca. Yes, I'm Canadian. Don't hold that against me.
It just means you're really nice.
Super nice.
You've been listening to the Citadel Cafe, where we are fast, easy, and cheap, but you can only pick two.